Welcome to Big Blend Radio, where we celebrate variety and how it adds spice to quality of life. Welcome, everybody. Today, we are super excited to welcome acclaimed author Catherine K. Abdul-Baki to the show to discuss her new memoir. It is out now, and it is called Dancing into the Light, An Arab-American Girlhood in the Middle East. It came out actually in September through She Writes Press, and we love them. And it follows her multicultural upbringing. It is pretty much a coming-of-age story where she's lived in different countries, and talking about her mom's background, her mom coming from Tennessee, her dad having an Arab cultural background. So she lived all over, and she's going to talk to us. She's been to Beirut, Lebanon, Jerusalem, Iran, Kuwait, America. And welcome to the show, Catherine. How are you?
I'm just fine. Thank you so much, Lisa. This is a very nice opportunity. I appreciate it.
Excited to have you on the show. I know Nancy, my mom and I, really are about getting people to understand that their coexistence can happen. And I think right now, what's happening, especially in Israel and Ukraine, and you know, we look at what's going on in the world, that we need to have these discussions more. And I think memoir. I know you've written a lot of nonfiction as well, also set over in the Middle East, but between both, the arts have always played a role of unity, telling the truth and giving people stories that they can relate to more than, you know, headlines on news that could be opinionated sometimes. But someone's personal story, like your memoir, your story, may, resonate with people to have a bit more understanding about coexistence and acceptance of different cultures. What do you think?
I totally agree. Actually, most of my other work has been fiction, but this is my first nonfiction book-length book. I did write journalism before, but even in the fiction, I wanted to bring out, you know, how we touch each other, how close we are, how similar we are, even if they're different cultures. I think by going into a character's psyche and heart, you identify with that character no matter what culture they're from. Mm-hmm. And I certainly grew up bicultural. I grew up in the Middle East, but with an American mother and an Arab father, he's Palestinian from Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And I, experienced both sides in my family, but there was really, it was pretty seamless in terms of their parenting was, I never felt there was a pull and push of any one culture or religion or another. They seem to pretty much handle it very well. And my hope is that people will see that, you know, cross-cultural marriages and interactions do work. It's the way to bring everyone close together.
Yes. And right now with what's going on in the world, these wars, mm-hmm. People start to take sides, and even if they've never been to that country, or maybe even understand or know people, you know what I mean? And that's, I'm seeing people just starting to pick sides and going, do you know, like, to me, war is just, do we have to have it? Like, I know that's altruistic, right?
But no, absolutely. Absolutely. I agree.
Yeah. It's a way, a memoir is a way for people to maybe open their eyes, just, you know, in their hearts. Oh yeah, I identify with you. Oh, I never realized, you know, that I would identify maybe with someone from an Arab or Middle Eastern background. And, all I say is this: coexistence, cultural connectivity brings about a lot of good food.
That's so true.
Stepping stone. You know, I'm starting to read about you and read your memoir. I'm going, you know what? I know she knows some really good food, you know, that we should be jealous of the culinary, you know, life you've had too. Music, learning different languages, travel, I think living in different cultures also gives you this kind of, more of a global perspective, but you understand when things go wrong, you understand the power of community too, whether or not your community's in that town where you're at, but also cultural community, like having a village, even if you're in a different country.
Correct. True.
Let's talk a little bit about, let's just start from the beginning a bit. We can't give it all away because we want everyone to buy your memoir, okay? So everyone, again, it's Dancing into the Light, an Arab American girlhood in the Middle East. And you can go to Catherine's website, CatherineAbdulBaki.com. Did I pronounce your last name correct?
Yes, you did. So,
Okay, good.
yes.
I get 5 points here. Okay. So go to our website. The link is in the show notes. So it'll be there so you can click real easy, go to Amazon, all those places. But let's start about where you were born. Talk a little bit about your parents, how they met, and where you were born.
Well, my mother was from Nashville, and she had decided by her third year of college, she went to Vanderbilt and then Northwestern, that she was taking a break from college. So she came to Washington, D.C. My father happened to be here doing some graduate work. He'd come from Jerusalem about 4 years earlier, done his undergraduate at University of New Mexico in Michigan State, and then came to Washington to do some graduate work and to find work, through the grapevine. He heard it was a good place to go. And they met one night in a delicatessen, a Middle Eastern delicatessen where my father worked, and my mother used to drop by to buy groceries. And she was 19, he was 22, and they fell madly in love at that point and got married. I was born here. But a few years later, my father had a job overseas in Tehran with the Department of Defense to open English language schools for the officers who wanted to learn English there. And so we went to Tehran.
Wow. And so going there, that how old were you then when you were
I
there?
was four. And but I recall pretty much a lot of things of Tehran, childhood memories, but it was very different. I learned Farsi. I spoke Farsi just from picking it up here and there. I remember the cold weather there in the winter, the just the Iranian culture, the foods. I think when you mentioned food, the Iranian food I can still see the sautéed onions and the rice, lentils and the spices, and that made an impression on me. Seeing our gardener, we had a gardener who knitted his own socks. I'd never seen any man do that, It was just sipping hot cups of tea with a sugar lump in your mouth, the way Iran often do. I'd never seen that, but these make an impression on a young child. And for some reason, I think because I was an only child for a long time, I absorbed all this, and I had those memories that are very clear to me.
And it's interesting. I was an only child as well, growing up. I have brothers somewhere in the world, but just growing up in Kenya, pretty much in my formative years, I lived with two different tribes at one point, and just. We also lived with a Muslim family for a while. And the food, the tea, oh my gosh. Seriously, the tea, there's nothing like it. I can't explain it to people, but I find it interesting about your mom actually going to a Middle Eastern grocery store because I think there's something about the spices that maybe might have attracted her to the store. Maybe, I don't know. I have a friend, Ruth Milstein. She's on our show all the time. She's from Israel and she's a cooking expert. And she sent me turmeric once, and I'm like, this is the best turmeric. She says, it's from
Yes.
Israel.
Of
You can't
course,
beat it.
it's very
Everything
different.
from Israel is pure, And so I'm like, okay. But I mean, she's right. It was the best turmeric I've ever had. And so, she's very adamant. And back east really has the stores. Just with us traveling and going, in Maryland and in your area in Virginia. The stores have far more Middle Eastern food than on the West Coast, it seems to me.
Oh, interesting. Yes. Well,
Yeah,
we have a
different, well,
large
different states.
population.
Yeah, Michigan and the Midwest also. So I'm like, oh, good, we can get good spices. It's all about the spice. But the tea, growing up that way and the same kind of foods, we also ate a lot with our hands. You'd wash in bowls of water and then I don't know if you ever experienced that too, eating like different cultures. Some it's a no-no, and some it's like that's how we live. So, did you ever experience that kind of change?
Well, not really, because our household was very American, and so my mother was very particular about table manners, Western table manners. And but we did, and there's a little part in my book where there's a little bit of a clash between her and my father. Middle Eastern food, you dip a lot with bread, so you use the bread to dip into olive oil and spices, za'atar in our case, or into hummus, or into baba ghanoush. You can put them into your plate, but it's also acceptable to take a piece of bread and to dip it, into a communal plate, kind of, using a piece of bread as instead of a utensil. In Jordan, they have a dish, and Palestine, they have a dish called mensef, which is big rice with lamb, and people traditionally eat that with their hands, with the right hand only, because the right hand is considered the one you use. And so I've seen that, but that was not a part of my everyday growing up.
Yeah, because your mom being very on the Western, like, and then she made you go to school and learn how to speak and write in Arab. I mean, that's like, how do you, I mean, that's not easy. I had to do that with different languages too. As a kid, it's easier than an adult, but like Arab, like to me, that's like a whole different writing profile.
Well, and it was because in where we were in Kuwait when she did that, we had moved there by then, and I was 6 years old, and she knew I was never going to learn Arabic at home because she didn't speak it, and the language we spoke at home was English with my dad. So she decided she was going to put me into a little village school, where they were all local girls, Kuwaiti girls, and also other Arabs, Lebanese, Palestinians, Syrians, whose parents worked in Kuwait. And so the only people who spoke English there were the teachers. So I had to quickly learn Arabic, and she was adamant that I learn Arabic. She never learned much except for a few words to get by with. But she was adamant that I learn it. And I was very unhappy at first because, of course, I didn't speak any language. I look different from everybody. I'm a redhead with freckles. And when you're 6 years old, you don't want to look different from everybody. Everybody else had this beautiful amber skin and dark hair, So I was with this little in this little girls' school in a fishing village called Shuaiba in Kuwait. And that's where I first learned Arabic.
Wow. What was it like growing up in these different countries in the Middle East? Because one of the main reasons that I also wanted you on the show was to talk about being a woman of Arab culture, right, and background, right? And living in these countries, because oftentimes, and I don't believe, I know better, but I've heard things where people will think women are subservient. And from my upbringing and living in a Muslim household, that is absolutely not true at all. The woman actually ruled the roost in different ways. There were just cultural, it was almost like protections. And there are some negatives that we know, right? But, and that's with many cultures around the world for women in general. But what was it like? Can you let people know, just don't put women down over there. It's, I think that's something we need to talk about as a global issue with women and growing up. There's just different rules that women have been raised under, but at the same time, it doesn't mean that they are behind. Do you know what I mean? Like, we're not.
Oh, absolutely. Now, my experience growing up in the Middle East, I never experienced that women were subservient to men, even in my dad's Middle Eastern household in Jerusalem. There was a respect for the men. They went out and they did work and they came back and, meals were on the table and stuff like that. But I never ever felt women were subservient in any way or had less rights. Now, like all cultures, you're going to have instances where women are put down, and we have to talk about that as well, when we're talking about that. But when I was growing up, I never really felt anyone was put down. There were things, there were accepted roles, let me put it that way. Accepted things.
Well,
I mean, for
well
example,
put.
My little school, my little village school, they let us out 10 minutes before they let out the boys' school next door so that girls could get home before the boys came out, because they did not want the sexes intermingling in the street, you know.
Right.
But we sort of accepted that, you know, we just accepted the boys were going to run out like hooligans and, you know, tease us or taunt us or something. So we, I mean, I was taken home by a driver in a car because I lived, you know, 10 minutes away by car. But the other girls walked in the streets. They did, you know, they went to the dry cleaners, to the laundry, to the stores. They did, you know, whatever. But there were certain rules and of roles, you know, that each gender did. But I never felt that women were downtrodden or put down. And certainly in places like Lebanon and Syria, you know, which were much more open than in Kuwait at that time. I'm talking about the 50s, the late 50s and early 60s. Women had a lot of, I mean, we were wearing mini skirts in Beirut. We were wearing bikinis on the beach, you know, Kuwait, everyone was who wanted to could swim, Arabs and non-Arabs. So I never really felt in my family, and certainly not in my household, that women were put down.
And women, you know, are strong in different cultures. I mean, in Africa, they're, it's a complex thing. It's complicated. Let's
Yes,
put it that way
it
to
is.
bring up. But I think it's, even if it's complex and complicated, it should be part of conversations, globally. And, you know, in Africa, African women, depending on where, some were in really bad situations of, you know, being raped all the time by their husband, parents selling them off. And, you know, even that's women being mutilated, you know. But at the same time, depending on where and how and if education was brought in or there was also really incredibly strong women that you do not mess with the mama. You do not mess with her. She'll hit you over the head with a shoe, you know. And I mean it in you know, just I not derogatory when I say that. And they were not, you know, people kind of look down going, oh, if men are treating this way, that they're lower. They're not. That doesn't mean that they're not smart. Doesn't mean that they don't have a soul. Does not mean that they don't have inner strength or strength to do the incredible. And that's what I witnessed growing up. And that was pretty much in the late 70s, early 80s. And 90s, early 90s, throughout Kenya, South Africa. We lived in England too. And, just different. And also different. Almost, do you feel like we should be looking at just meet people and communicate with them instead of almost having like a pretense of what a culture is? Like sometimes just connect with people and get to know them.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we, you know, we form these stereotypes in our head now. You know, some people cover their head with the hijab, you know, if they're Islamic. This is often a choice. I'm very much against anybody being forced to cover or to do this, but often it's the person themselves that they're devout or they believe in this. And that should be, we should not form a stereotype just because someone is covering their hair, you know? I've never covered, no one in my family ever covered. I mean, even except the old ladies, you know, would cover their hair with kind of a shawl kind of thing. But other women have chosen to do this. Maybe it's a sort of a political statement people in some parts of the world are having, you know, trying to form an identity. I'm not sure. Some of it's truly religious. But I think we form stereotypes in our head, and other cultures do about Americans as well. You know, it's not just
the ugly American traveler.
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, somehow Westerners are looked upon as inferior in a funny way there, you know, like they're not Arab. You know, we are much more noble and better. You know, I mean, there are some people who say that
we have the medjool dates and the oil. That's that.
Yes, right. I mean, every culture, I think, not demonizes, but dehumanizes another culture. So There are many things in the Arab culture, I would say, that in terms of women's rights that certainly need work on, and the legal system and things like that. But I mean, we had until some years ago, things like honor killing in some parts of the Middle East, you know, where a woman who transgressed, had, you know, married, I mean, sex out of wedlock or something was punishable almost by death by one of her cousins or brothers to, you know, clear the family name, this kind of sort of backward thinking. But this is rare. It is rare, but we have to, you know, enforce laws that stop that from happening. I mean, we have wife beaters in this country, right? We have abusers in this country. But so everywhere, I think male dominance has been sort of a general rule. But I don't find that in the Middle East, women have inferior views of themselves at all.
That's my point of this is, like, you know, women just, get to know people. And I think if you look at every country, there's been slavery. Every country, there's been abuse, not just to women, but to men. You know, men do things to men, you know, cultures
Absolutely.
Do things to cultures. So that's the way that goes. Growing up there, though, too, in the eras that you did, the timeline, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, those time frames, I think you also paint this picture of beauty and a joyous regions, you know, just different than what we, you know, you talk about going to Hawaii, and, you know, that wasn't as, you know, a safe feeling because of nuclear, what was going on, you know? So nuclear drills and things like that. My mom remembers that going to school in California, like, get under the desk, you know, things like that. And in Africa, me growing up, I was taught how to, you know, discern guns, like from an AK-47 and what a limpet mine looks like and things like that. So I was raised a little different, but I don't know, you just kind of do it. You just got to hope everything's fine. It's weird, huh?
Well, you know, I mean, I have, you know, some grandchildren here, young grandchildren, and I shudder to think that at this point in time, they're going to have active shooter drills in school. I mean, what kind of childhood is that? I assure you, there is not a single place in the Middle East where that was ever or will ever be considered a drill to give children. But people don't run around there with guns, don't have access to guns, I should say, if it's not a war zone now, you know, that there's a distinction there. But I just, when I first went to Hawaii and I went for an extra month, we stayed there rather because Kuwait was so hot to go back to. So in August, we wouldn't go back till late September when school started. And so I'd go for a month into the local public school in Hawaii. And I was shocked on the first or second day when, you know, the teachers were drilling people on asking them, quizzing them on what they would do if there was a bomb. And people were coming up with all kinds of, like you said, your mom did, you know, hiding under the desk or hitting the dust or whatever. And I thought, this is so weird. I could not wait to get back to Kuwait where, you know, these things were not a topic.
Yeah. Yeah, because when I was growing up in South Africa, there was all kinds of stuff going on in Kuwait that, you know, was not like you were like, oh, we're glad we're not in Kuwait right now.
Right.
You know, as teenagers, we thought, well, if we're going to get in trouble, at least we're not in trouble in Kuwait. You know, that was kind of a saying in my high school.
That's interesting. What years were that?
Oh, boy, that was the late 80s. Going 91, I graduated.
Oh.
Now everybody knows my age. Yes.
Okay.
Graduated 91. So. Yeah, that was the time frame, and we go, well, at least, you know,
that was the invasion,
but
the
South
Iraqi
Africa
invasion, the Iraqi
yep.
invasion of Kuwait. So that would have been normal, of course. That was a very a very bad year.
But you know what I think we what's so important about your memoir and your story is you're reminding people of some of the roots and you know, we think of Kuwait now, I think that's what we think of immediately. And, you know, I think about when I was, you know, in high school going with Kuwait, we were going through a crazy time too with South Africa at the time, you know,
Oh, right.
and And
Right.
it affected every culture in South Africa, what was going on. And apartheid was horrible. It was also, at one point it was, my mom has been kicked out of going into a restaurant because she was a female. So it wasn't just apartheid on black people or anybody of color. It was apartheid on women in
Oh
South
my
Africa
goodness.
at a specific time, and people have forgotten that. This is the men's only restaurant. Don't you dare go in there. You were looked down on like you were a lady of the night.
Well, I would say yes, that sort of thing. That in general in the Middle East, you do have, or you did have when I was growing up. Now it's not so common. You had men's cafe. And so the men would go there after dinner in the evening and play backgammon or cards or smoke argile, the water pipe. And this was a men's only for sure. No woman would have dreamt of going there. Maybe a little girl could run in to notify her dad that he was needed at home, but nobody could actually go in there and sit. That was not done. So I can identify with that. It was just like, for a woman to walk into maybe a men's only cigar lounge here or something, it's something.
Well, but it wasn't always even, my mom also just, she's an American, right? And with an American brain and going, this is what I'm used to. And that's not, that's those things that you have to kind of learn as you go into another culture
Right,
and adopt
absolutely.
and grow with. And it's
Exactly.
not necessarily, it sounds bad, but it's not, it's kind of like the women have their own thing going too.
Oh,
So,
absolutely. And no man would be permitted to walk into a women's area in a household. If it was one of those conservative households where they have a separate place for women to gather and mothers and daughters and sisters and in-laws, and men would not wander in there, or they would politely knock so there is kind of segregation there in traditional areas now. We're not talking about the big cosmopolitan cities. That doesn't happen. But so it was there are those rules and things, but they're kind of, if you grow up with those, you learn to kind of early on accept them and you know how to navigate them. It never occurred, like for example, on feast days in Jerusalem, when it was a Islamic holiday, the men went to the mosque. The women didn't go to the mosque. They were home cooking. And so the men would go to the mosque, say the prayers, the holiday prayers, the Eid prayers. They'd then go to the cemetery to visit the deceased relatives. That was a tradition. And then they'd come home. By then there would be a big feast prepared, like a Thanksgiving feast, But the women never went to the mosque in those days. That everybody knew their role, and it wasn't that one was subservient to the other. It was just, this is the way it was,
Yeah, well, half the time when on the Americanized Anglo side, British, na you name it, right? If they say prayer at dinner, grace, saying grace, it's usually the man at the head of the table. What's the difference, right? So
Absolutely.
there's no difference, and it's kind of like, well, that's your duty. This is my duty. Kind of
Right.
splitting up what you're supposed to do.
Right.
I remember going to a mosque in Durban in South Africa and getting in trouble for my shoes, taking my shoes off. Both of us had to take our shoes off, Nancy and I.
Right.
But I remember just, I learned so much and it made me really think about different religions. It was very fascinating because of, they were like, well, the Bible's younger. And anyway, that's a whole other conversation. But it was just, it made me really, as a young person, open my mind to different religions. And that was really a kind of one of those things that happen in life that really change you. And to be way, I think it was just, I was younger, I was like 13 or something. And kind of at that point where I was coming of age, like what your memoir is telling your story of
Right,
growing up.
right.
And I remember going, oh, well, this is what they believe here. Well, let me dig into that. And then I'm like, this isn't sounding so bad. Then I'll go listen to, a different, my best friend was Muslim. She was a naughty girl, though. She got into trouble. She misbehaved.
They have
Her
naughty
dad, her,
Muslims too.
oh, her dad got on. Ooh, yeah. She was a bad girl, but she was very sweet. And I loved Nesli. I loved her. But you go into a different side of town with a different belief and culture and hear the religious beliefs and you go, oh, wait a minute, this sounds even more cooler. Like, you know what I mean? So you can't really, it acceptance is so much easier and far more fun. Like I said, we go back to good food, but growing up, I want to go back to your mom and losing your mom, especially at the age that you were losing your mom. Like, I think I would have completely lost it. My mom and I are so close. And being an only child and pretty much a single mom life, right? For majority of the time. If something had happened, there were people that I can trust that would have helped. But it had to have been different for you living in these different countries when the household was kind of Americanized, and yet you were in these different Middle Eastern countries. That had to have been different for you.
It was because we always had a very American household. The woman, I think, sets the tone of the house. And my mother was unapologetically a Southern American woman from Tennessee. She never wore any Arab dress or converted, or she was really not religious at all. But so the tone of my home was very secular, very open, very Western. And my dad went along with everything, Thanksgiving, Easter, Christmas. He was Muslim, but he didn't have any qualms about celebrating all of that. We made big to-dos of Christmas trees and gifts and Easter bunnies and all that stuff. So I forgot what you were asking about my
No,
mother,
I was
but
good about your mom, but
yes.
yeah, going
And so
from, yeah, having like.
the atmosphere in the home was very, very Western, very American, I would add, because we lived in an American compound, American British compound, that was an oil company, comp. So our friends were mostly Americans and Brits. And so when she died, I was 11, when she died, that really changed because the people who came to take care of me, her side of the family were all of course, in the United States. We were in Kuwait. And my grandparents were in Honolulu. They were too far to come and take care of me. But my Arab aunts came from Jerusalem. They flew over to Kuwait and they would sort of come, one in particular, and stay with us for a few months. And I had a housekeeper also who was a Middle Eastern from Jerusalem. So but the Western part kind of went away slowly. And my father became, trying to raise a young girl on his own. Reverted back to the sort of traditional Arab culture he had grown up with, And so the whole tone of the house slowly, slowly began to change. And then, of course, he remarried later. And when I was 12 and a half, he remarried an Arab woman. And so then, of course, that sort of solidified a much more Middle Eastern atmosphere in my home. It was a little bit sort of confusing. And I was a little resentful of that, He became a lot more, like probably many fathers of teenage girls, a lot more controlling and wanting to make sure I wasn't not going to be getting into trouble. So there were a lot more rules than some of my American friends had, and I resented that. So that was
I
a
think,
big
yeah.
shift in the household.
But you gotta also kind of, I think, as an adult later, do you look back and go, okay, well, he's a father, protective, and this is what I know.
He was trying his best to keep me respectable, say that, and in an Arab culture, because all of our friends were also, we had a lot of Arab friends, family, and so had I been running around doing what all the American kids did, preteen and teenagers, I would have definitely been slandered by our more conservative friends who would have thought I was, just a loose girl, a quote unquote. I mean, it wasn't much difference from, say, life in a small town USA, a couple of decades ago, in the South, when I, some decades ago, where people are more conservative, people, know everybody and talk about everybody and, that kind of thing. So he was really reverting to what he thought would make me be respected in the long run in my community. And I don't blame him for that. I mean, sometimes I feel he was a little bit too rigid, He could, you know, but it's the fear, as you say, a parent's fear that their daughters or sons, in some cases, you know, will harm themselves.
Have, or someone will harm them, especially
Or
for
someone
a
will harm
woman.
them is more. Yeah. Well, I mean, we were, but that was in my teenage years, that was in the 60s. And of course, you know, there were drugs floating around, especially in the American teenage world. And my
Party
father
time.
heard about all this, even in Kuwait, you know, things happen. And so my father heard all these rumors. And of course, he decided not to let me go to these American parties that I wanted to go to, that somehow certain times got out of hand, you know. And I resented that. But what do
Oh,
you know?
yeah, I got into enough trouble, and my mom being a single mom in Africa was not.
No, that must have been very difficult.
It was not easy. In Kenya, she even went to open a bank account and had she couldn't in a post office box, couldn't do it because she
But
was
you had a
female.
man.
And she would go out in the street and find a guy and just would pick him up and say, "Okay, you're opening the you're helping me. Just stand there."
Yeah, that's true. And those are the parts that I feel, you know, we need to change in Middle Eastern culture.
Well, I'll call. I don't. Sorry, but it. I mean, look at what's going on in the States now. So I'm sorry. We
Right,
need to.
Well,
It
we're,
is.
yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
I think we just, and I think that's the other part is, you've got a an interesting way of bringing balance through your stories, and I tell everybody about the dance part because I think dance is this. And it's interesting because you talk about your dad on this conservative side of like protective and everything. Yet dance is freeing, right? But then if you don't have, you have to know the, if you're going to do like ballroom or something, right? You have to know the steps and the rules to be able to be free and look free as a performance.
Correct. You know, my dad was, when he came to the United States as a 17-year-old student, at some point, he took ballroom dance lessons and he learned to dance, and he probably had a lot of innate musical ability. And so he was always a very good dancer. And in the 50s and 60s, when I was growing up, Latin dancing was very big. All over, everywhere, you know, it hit the Jamaican, Harry Belafonte, you know, all this musical influences from Afro-Cuban music was sort of coming into the U.S., and then it also went overseas. So when
And
I
it is sexy. I'm sorry, but
started,
it is. It's sexy music. It
oh,
is.
very sexy music, and my dad would, we had all these Harry Belafonte musics and cha-cha-cha, rumba, you know, Latin music, Italian music. And so he would constantly be putting music on at home, and we would dance. He and I would dance, he and my mother would dance. There were dance parties of the adults always that, you know, I could somehow attend for a while before I was put to bed. And so I grew up with people dancing, and even the women in my Arab family, I have an aunt who was very musical, and she would shimmy and dance, you know, whenever she was cleaning house or something,
Oh,
listen to
yeah.
the blaring radio. This was, I grew up thinking all Arabs could dance. You know, this was just my, because there's always music in the streets. If you walk down any Arab streets, North Africa, I don't know about Kenya, but if you walk down the street in
Oh,
Tunisia,
yeah.
Morocco, you hear music blaring from balconies, from,
Yes.
and people are dancing. And so it was a surprise to me when I started to teach dance that I found there were a lot of Arabs who couldn't dance, who hadn't been exposed. So again, it depends on your family and how, you know, how musical or, you know, open to dancing they were. But mostly, dancing was not a new thing for me growing up at all. But for some people, it was. But moving into more professional dancing, that was not something, for example, that I had expected to want to do, or that even that my father approved of at that point. Of course, I was married and I didn't have to ask his permission, but I could tell that he thought it was kind of silly and kind of not proper for, it was not ladylike for me to go out and, you know, teach dance or perform dance. He didn't mind if I went out and danced with my husband, that was fine. But he sort of frowned upon the idea that I would be teaching dancing to strangers or performing. Heaven forbid that I'd be out on a stage performing. But he sort of turned the other way, turned, what do you say, turned a blind eye to it. But he sort of stopped being the kind of enthusiastic dancer he was in his youth. He became sort of like put that aside as that was my youth, you know, which is sort of sad. But occasionally he would get up and dance with us when we asked him. But I don't know. For me, it was such a part of my nature from watching it as a child that I just got into it at some point. By that point, I'd been a novelist for some years and I'd published and all of that, but I wanted to get away from the computer and move more. And I loved all the Latin music came back into my life, as the memoir will sort of lead you to see.
I love it. I love it. I think it's so important. Dance, and dance is very so little written about it too. Especially in fiction. We need more dance fiction. We've interviewed maybe two to three authors over four. Oh, five now. I mean, that's how few, and we've done like, I don't know, probably thousands of interviews at this point. I mean, we've been doing this for over 16, 17 years. So it's just
Wow.
so rare to have dance it be part of it. And I think we need more. So I think it's I love that you bring that into your memoir, but very cool to have you on the show and appreciate you sharing your story and having this discussion too. And I want everyone to go to your website. KatherineAbdulbaki.com is the website. Again, the memoir is called Dancing into the Light, an Arab American Girlhood in the Middle East. And before you go, what is one thing if a young woman reads your book that you want her to get out of it,
Well, I'd
wherever
love,
she is in the world?
wherever she is in the world, I'd love her to know that she should follow her passion and her dreams. And my mother did that when she married a foreigner. She always wanted to go beyond her cultural limitations. And I have done that in my writing by pursuing my dream of dance. I think anything a woman wants to do, she should pursue. And there's joy in it, and there's light at the end of the tunnel always. That's what dancing into the light meant, kind of that, you know, through the sadness and darkness that you may pass through, you will come to a beautiful time in your life and pursue your dreams. Don't let anyone stop you from pursuing your dreams.
Exactly. And everyone also go look up Catherine's fiction. You got five books that are fiction, right? For everyone
Correct.
to dig into as well. I love that you wrote out one more thing. I know you have to go, but writing. When did you realize you wanted to write? Like, what led you to put pen to paper?
My dad kind of put the idea in my head when I was about 12 years old, when I asked him one day, what should I be when I grow up? And he said, be a writer like your mother. My mom was she'd studied journalism and she loved to write. I don't know that she published very early on at 17. She had a story in 17 magazine. But he thought that would be a good career for me, because I could sort of write and be home with my kids. I mean, it was sort of an old-fashioned idea, but that lodged the idea in my head, and I just found that I had a knack for writing and I loved it. And that, you know, that it never entered my mind not to be a writer after age 12, let's put it that way.
I love it. I love it. I know you also speak at universities and speak to women's groups too. So we love what you're doing. Again, everyone, we've got the link up for Catherine's website in the show notes. We want to thank everyone for joining us here on Big Blend Radio. Take care, everyone, and thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you, Lisa. This was a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Big Blend Radio. Keep up with our shows at bigblendradio.com.